According to unsilenced.org, every year thousands of children are sent against their will, often ripped out of their beds in the middle of the night by strangers, and they're brought to private facilities to be treated for various mental illnesses, including addiction and other perceived behavioral problems. This might be a problem, though, in terms of an industry. We're going to talk about it today on the Citizen Steward Show. Welcome to the Citizen Steward Show, a podcast about education and democracy, where we dive deep into the headlines and add new perspectives about how America educates its young. I'm Citizen Steward.
And I'm Kate Malikoff.
And this is the Citizen Steward Show. Let it begin. So, Kate, we got you back again another week. I feel like this is becoming a thing. I think it's a thing. And I think we're just going to, like, you know, get you a chair with your name on the back of it, you know, at the Citizen Steward Show.
It's an honor to be part of the Citizen Steward Show community.
It is an honor to have your wisdom with us and your sharp mind and your sharp wit with us. So you wanted to make a plug right at the beginning here about a new podcast that's coming to the Branch Media. So why don't you tell us what that is?
Yes, we are very excited. The National Parents Union podcast will release their first episode this Wednesday. So that's each week. Carrie, Tafshir, Ariel, and Bernita will dive into the issues that matter most around education and economics and how it impacts kids and families. So these four women are powerhouses. They run the National Parents Union, which, Chris, I know you have not only been involved in, but received an award from in the past. They do incredible work. So I'm really glad that each week now, parents and really anyone who cares about kids or what's going on in our country are going to get to hear from these four women. So we'll share the link to that podcast in the episode description today.
So I just want to say for everybody, go to my Substack, citizen.substack.com. You'll see a piece that I wrote last week about NPU, the National Parents Union, and just a little bit of my history that I remember, like my oral history of what I remember from the NPU starting out. Carrie Rodriguez, who leads that organization, has been on this show before. She's actually been a guest of ours. She, like, powerhouse isn't the right word, I think, 100% to describe her, because she is scrappy, man. She is like just a whirlwind in Chuck Connors, and she will outwork you and is doing great work. And Bernita Bradley, who's also going to be on the show, her and I go way back. She was doing work in Detroit, the Parent Action Network, years ago. That was really the basis for what a lot of people who do parent activism took a look at it and really learned from. So please go back and watch that. In other news, it's Earth Day. And I say that like I know what it means, like I've ever celebrated before. Like, Earth Day, is there a cake or something for Earth Day? Do I get presents? Does anybody send me a card? Like, what is Earth Day? I really don't know, but I did fall down this Earth Day rabbit hole because I am paying more attention to things that have to do with NASA. And it popped up in my feed that NASA is in keeping with Earth Day. They have announced 6 new airborne missions to study our changing planet. These missions are set to deploy from 2026 to 2029, and they'll focus on various aspects such as Arctic coastal change, wildfire weather creation, urban air pollution, impacts of changing weather patterns on landscapes, retreating glaciers, and agriculture. It's $120 million that they're putting into this. That's not chump change. And, you know, I love all things NASA because I'm just kind of fascinated with the whole space thing. So anyways, happy Earth Day. Do you, like, have a special party or something you throw for Earth Day?
Every year. I mean, the fact that you don't is really wild to me. No, you know what? I remember Earth Day in schools, but I don't really know what we do outside of that. And I was actually thinking about you, Chris, because I know you've got kids at different ages, and I'm curious if they'll come home today talking about Earth Day.
We will see. But in my time as a parent, I don't remember them ever coming home with something from Earth Day. But I do think it's interesting that I didn't learn anything about it. I will put in another plug for the last school that we visited in Minnesota. The school's an expeditionary school where they totally do use the earth to teach. They teach all different kinds of lessons through trips into nature and into the wilderness. And I'm kind of turned on by that message right now because I kind of feel like that would have been good for me way back when. So anyways, happy Earth Day, everybody. If you want to find out more, I did not know, but the government, the United States government, has a website on Earth. And it's the domain is just pretty on the nose. It's called earth.gov. So if you want to find out more, that's where you find out. All right. Next in the news, California's governor has gotten pretty gangster with his national messages that he puts out in the world. I think he's trolling Republican governors pretty hard, and I don't think that they're coping. I think they need to cope harder. But anyways, let's take a listen to this ad that he has put out, and we'll talk about it a little bit.
We're almost there. You're going to make it.
Trump Republicans want to criminalize young Alabama women who travel for reproductive care.
Miss, I'm going to need you to step out of the vehicle, take a pregnancy test.
Stop them by taking action at righttotravel.org.
Now, I don't know that hearing it and not seeing it does it full justice. So for those of you, you know, who are listening right now, it's two women driving in a car. They obviously are leaving a state where abortion is illegal to try and make it to a state where they can get an abortion. And they think they're just about to escape, and a cop comes behind them, pulls them over, and demands that they get out the car and take a pregnancy test. This is something that Gavin Newsom, it's in line with Newsom's picking on red states thing, like wherever he can. And I think he's pretty good at it, to be very honest with you. I'm not the target of this ad. I don't know what the insecurity would feel like to know that something I needed majorly done in a medical decision would almost make me an outlaw in my state. I live in Minnesota. We're better than everybody, so we don't do things like this. Joking. But I can't imagine having to drive to Wisconsin, for instance, to, you know, get a kidney transplant or something, you know, just something that I should be deciding for myself. Does this hit for you, Kate? Do you find this compelling?
I mean, that ad feels like it should be a plot line in Grey's Anatomy, not in real life. It belongs on a soap opera. Chris, I think I am also not quite the target population in that I live in New York, but if I did live in Arizona, I have the means to leave Arizona if I needed to get an abortion or any other procedure that I couldn't get in the state. But I worry a lot about people who can't get the care that they need, who either don't have the financial ability to travel a long distance, or, and I think actually we've seen this happening in Texas a few times already, who are maybe they're trapped in a situation with where abuse is part of the challenge. And so being able to leave home for a week to get a procedure is simply not an option for them. And so, while I think he's painting a pretty dystopian picture, I think that there are people for whom that is a reality right now.
Yeah, it feels like it's dystopian, but too close to reality. And that might be the point of the whole ad. Do you think anybody's going to, would this change somebody's vote? Or would this be a major factor in their vote?
If it is, I don't think they're going to tell anyone that it is. But I think that we have a chance of seeing quiet voters on election day.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'll say about it. This is all about our democracy and what we're allowed to do by right or by, you know, law or rule in the United States. And like I said, you know, I kind of joked that I live in Wobegon. I live in Minnesota. There's just a certain set of things that I just don't have to worry about. There are things that I know for a fact that my government's going to get right. We're not going to stop anybody from eating school lunch. As a matter of fact, we're going to make sure that everybody gets school lunch and recess and playgrounds. And now, you know, gender bathrooms. So the state is putting out money to schools to be able to create all gender bathrooms, which, by the way, people, it's weird that we make such a big deal and it's such a problem out of some of these things that are so fixable. Anyways, come to Minnesota. You won't have to worry about all these things. The cold keeps the riffraff out. That's our joke. That's the joke. Like, not just anybody can move up here. But all right, well, moving on to the next piece of news. Google's head, Sundar Pichai, and I don't know if I'm saying his name the right way, says that workplace and politics don't mix. This comes after he fired several, I think 28 pro-Palestinian protesters inside the company. These protesters inside the company were protesting the cloud account that Google uses or actually contracts with the Israeli government for. So this from MSN. Last week, employees across Google offices in New York, Seattle, Sunnyvale, California, they all stage a 10-hour sit-in in protest of the company's involvement in Project Nimbus, a 1.2 $2 billion Israeli government cloud contract. Some staff were spotted wearing t-shirts bearing the slogan, Google Against Genocide, and occupying the office of Thomas Kurian. That's Google's chief cloud executive. These names are killing me. Chief cloud executive. Well, I want to be chief RAIN executive. In the aftermath, Google's head of security, Chris Racow, wrote in an internal memo that the protests made coworkers feel threatened before warning those who were tempted to violate the company's policies in the future to think again. What do you think about this? Like, politics and workplace don't mix, just keep it out of the workplace.
This is so tough. To this issue specifically, I actually did some digging, and in 2021, Google and Amazon employees banded together to write an op-ed in The Guardian saying they weren't comfortable with Google and Amazon's contracts around Project Nimbus. So I think it's important to name that. I think a lot of the advocacy around this specific contract and topic has been going on for a while. I think to your broader question, though, Chris, do politics in the workplace mix? I just don't know if we know where the line is anymore. And so I think it is 2024, and we now, the majority of people who are in a workplace have been taught that the personal is political and the political is personal. So how do you keep it out of the workplace? At the same time, I worked in HR for several years, and so I also understand just how difficult it is to actually say, we have people, especially in a private company, who are responsible for doing certain things, and if we bend our rules and regulations around how we can respond in one way, then we will have to do it for 10 other situations, and then we completely lose track of where the line is. And so what I don't know is whether or not Google has dealt with similar sit-ins and how they've handled them in the past, but I'd be curious about that.
You know, for us, Kate, like for me, I run EdPost, you run and Ravi run The Branch Media. We talk about politics all the time, so it's part of our workplace. So a conversation internally with my staff wouldn't be completely out of character to talk about all of these issues because we're going to have to cover them. But, you know, I'd say that in knowing that, first of all, for people listening, the job that I have right now is my 43rd job in my life, just so you know. This is my 43rd job. And I would have to say in probably at least 40 of those jobs, talking about politics in the workplace probably wouldn't have been a smart thing to do. Only about 3 or 4 jobs, maybe 5, that I've had, it's part of the work. But other than that, I can remember when I worked in a company called Minnesota Mutual, which is now called Securian. I was like the guy in The Matrix who sat in a cube. You know, it was all these cubes. I was in cube world with a little headset and my pictures on my little cube, and, you know, I had made it. HR was really concerned about anything that made the environment, you know, hostile or unwelcoming for people. And if I were to come in, now, if I was working that job today and I were to come in and my cube mate sitting next to me was always talking about Trump. Trump, 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 Trump. It would change the nature of my work. It would change my feeling about coming to work and definitely at working at a place like that. So whereas I'm not a censorship dude, I mean, you said you were with HR. I would appreciate if HR kept our workplaces just kind of free of that so that we can just come and work and go home. It doesn't matter whether I agree with the issue here or not, like in Google. That's not really my criteria for how I understand it. It's different than that, because what if I didn't, you know, agree with what their issue is and I had to listen to it every day? Last thing I'll say too, and this is something for young people listening, protests aren't consequence-free and they never have been. So you do have a right to protest, and you have a right to bring this up, and you have a right to go against your employer. You don't have a right to do that and keep your $250,000 a year, your swimming pool at work, your bike shop at work, your credit union and launderer at work, the doggy cafe at work where you bring your dog into an actual cafe and all the things on the items are for your dog. So I guess all I'm saying is there are consequences to doing this. And if you're willing to take those consequences, by all means, protest away. Does it meet your HR criteria? Does it fit your HR-ness?
You pass. Although now I think I have to ask Ravi why we don't have a doggy cafe at the branch, because it sounds like I'm elevated. No, you meet my criteria. And I think you're allowed to leave a job that you don't agree with, that's not sitting well with you. If we were in a different labor market, I wonder if we would see these employees doing a sit-in or quitting because they had an easier time getting another job. I think this is part of why I volunteer a lot, is I never want the one job I have to be the thing that is where I funnel all of my passions and all of my opinions. And I think we've gotten away from that as a society. So volunteer.
That is super smart. Super smart to volunteer and get that out of your system in other places. And you could really live your values when you do that. If you're, you know, a person that your issue is domestic violence, the shelters need workers. They need, you know, help. So anyways, go volunteer, people. And one way you can volunteer is by leaving a comment about our show wherever you listen to it. Click on it and star it and leave a message to us. Just volunteer to help us get this show out to people that need it. We're an education show and ignorance is at an all-time high. So all education should be is ignorance mitigation. So, you know, it's your patriotic duty if you love America to leave a rating for this particular show. Anyways, let's move on. So the troubled teen industry and alternative education is our topic today. And this came to me, I think, a little bit sideways. I was first thinking about the alternative education movement, which has existed since the 1970s or beyond. And that has always been for the students that don't fit into traditional schools for some reason. Many have accused alternative education as being the dumping ground for the kids that public school doesn't want to work with. Students who get pregnant, students who have behavioral issues or situations, students that are often truant. Alternative ed becomes a way for them to get their credits, if they can, and to graduate. But this goes a little bit beyond that. So what I want to say is, first of all, have you ever heard of a school where silence is enforced, smiles are forbidden, and corrections rain down on even the smallest of infractions? And when I say corrections, that's in air quotes. Corrections being you have consequences for even the smallest of infractions. Well, this isn't dystopian fiction. It's the horrifying reality of teens who were sent to the academy at Ivy Ridge in New York. And in a new documentary on Netflix called The Program, it goes through this. Director Catherine Kubler is a survivor herself of one of these schools, and she has a pretty powerful three-part series on Netflix, which I would encourage us all to watch because it's a dark, dark hole you can go in. As a setup, let me take a different path at this just a little bit. So Clarence Thomas, a sitting Supreme Court justice, how does he relate to this story? Well, it's really funny because we talked about Harlan Crowe, who's the billionaire, who funded a lot of Clarence Thomas's lifestyle, you know, trips and vacations. But buried within all of that was the fact that Harlan Crowe paid for the tuition of Clarence Thomas's nephew at a school called Hidden Lakes Academy. And ProPublica did a whole article on this, and it's really interesting. The ProPublica article focused on the billionaire buying things for the Supreme Court justice. But even though they mentioned the tuition at Hidden Lakes Academy, they did not mention that it was a troubled teen school that now has gone out of business, went out of business in like 2011 or 2012. And had they done that, they would have fell down a rabbit hole of just how unregulated these schools are, how they're making kids do hard labor. They are abusing them physically, sexually in some cases, academically for sure. They're robbing them of an education. And they are using tactics that actually even prisoners have a right to not have to endure. And what's really interesting about this is prisoners have more rights than children do. So in the United States of America, your parents can say they don't like your attitude and they can hire one of these schools to pull you out of your bed at midnight while you sleep without telling you where you're going. And they throw you in the back of a car. And they take you in the dark to a place where you cannot escape because it's so far out in the wilderness. And you are there now for a couple of years. And the only way to come home is to pass the test, like, you know, pass everything that they throw at you. And the sad part about passing the test is they're not incentivized to have you pass the test. They're incentivized to keep you there because they're making about $6,000 or more a month off of you. So they send your parents things like, we're still working on them. They're not ready yet, you know, because they want to keep them. It's not really about children. When I say unregulated, these schools are seriously unregulated. They're not run by educators, oftentimes. They're run by business people who run it like a family business. they're very abusive. And the last thing I'll say about it is this has affected a lot of people, including Paris Hilton, who recently testified in California because they're passing a law in California to protect children from these type of schools and these type of organizations. And people may not know this, but at 17, Paris Hilton was put into one of these schools, and she only recently started talking about it in the last couple of years. And she says that she endured physical and sexual abuse in one of these, you know, one of these schools. So anyways, Kate, you watched this special, and I would want to know kind of like, what was your first kind of takeaway and reaction to the story?
Yes, Chris gave me the great pleasure of encouraging me to watch this special for this episode. Honestly, Chris, my first reaction was that I wasn't surprised. I think we have a very long history in this country of not knowing what to do when we are in situations with unchecked power. So, you know, we did an episode on the Lost Debate Power, I think last year, with an author, Christine Keneally, who wrote a book about the history of orphanages. And for a very long time, there were many orphanages, particularly runs Catholic orphanages, where much of the same behavior that we saw in this documentary was happening there. We hear about stories of what young people are going through in juvenile facilities that go well beyond what we're told happens in those facilities. And so I think that we have a big problem in this country, which is, why is it that when we are given, as adults, given the power to think about how a child spends every second of their day, that so often those situations become abusive? I'm curious why you think that is.
I mean, the overarching question that I have about all this is, how come kids don't have rights? Right? Like, you know, there's 11 states that still allow corporal punishment in schools, and there's no state where beating prisoners is okay. So you can whoop children, but you can't beat prisoners, right? And that says a lot about how we think about children. 2 years or so ago, I stopped calling myself an ed reformer or an ed activist or whatnot. And I rebranded myself as somebody who has worked in social services for years. I rebranded myself as a child justice advocate. And I think everything that we do in terms of advocacy should be about getting justice for children. And a story like this just proves to me how little justice there is for kids. Because even as we saw this special, the laws are still in place that allow it to happen. It's happening again. I mean, it's still happening right now as we talk. So to answer your question, I think a big part of this is that we have a skewed vision of children. We kind of romanticize it in one way, and then we justify it when we want to do something. It's for the kids. You know, like we justify things that we do for the kids. And then we just show in so many ways we don't give a damn about the kids. I think that there's another storyline here, though. With this particular story, I think for people that want to argue about government regulation and how much education needs to be regulated by government, I think this should be a warning to people who think that a free market, a completely free, deregulated market in education would be a good thing. Because one of the ways that this has been allowed to take place is that they're not regulated, that the state doesn't know. Well, it's not that the state doesn't know. The state doesn't have any motivation actually to come down on them. So I don't know where you are in your journey between leftist and libertarian, Kate, but if I were to ask you about like the regulation part of this, would you be pro-regulation? Would you be in the middle, or would you be like maybe some rules, but not necessarily regulation?
Well, I like to give complicated answers, Chris, but I had also written this down as a main takeaway was for our listeners. One of the things that you find out in this series is that this quote unquote school, because I don't think you can actually call it a school. And actually later we find out that even the diplomas they handed out were not legitimate, yeah, but they had received accreditation, which means that someone was supposedly coming to the school, looking at it, making sure that things were happening the way that they should be. And A, clearly not so much, or someone was paid off for not doing their job well. But I thought a lot about, there's been a lot, the Washington Post in particular has been doing really great reporting this year on the rise of homeschooling. And there are states like Michigan where there is almost no oversight of what homeschooling looks like. So I think this was back in December. So I don't know, because I think the rules were potentially changing, where you don't even have to report if you've made a decision that you are going to homeschool your child. And that state was focused on in particular because a child who had been homeschooled was murdered in their home. There was no one paying any attention to see what was happening. And so I think when we talk about regulation, Chris, I would love to talk about that in terms of what are kids learning, but I first care about are kids safe. And I think where that becomes complicated, Chris, is too many of our state systems don't have the ability to offer the safety net if something is not safe. So whether that is our foster care system, if a child should not be in the home that they are currently in because of a safety issue, whether that is the child tax care credit so that children are in families where they can afford for you to have food, but also whether that is in our schools where we have some wonderful schools and we have schools that are struggling to have teachers and have incredibly outdated curriculum. So I'd love to be on the side of regulation, but I think we've got to actually make sure that when we say we're going to enforce something, we can do it well.
I think United States is like one of those very rich countries that always says it can't afford a thing. So I think, let me make the case here a little bit for children in this particular situation. And I didn't even know there was a thing called the troubled teen industry. I didn't know that was like a whole industry. I didn't know 100% of what we do with so-called troubled teens. Now, these kids, I just want to say, range from not really doing much, but not believing in Jesus, to kids that have some real physical and mental kind of problems, right? So there's a range of this troubled teen. I don't know if you remember, but we used to do this thing, not we, but there used to be this thing called Scared Straight, where they would take juvenile delinquents to prison and have the prison guys kind of like rough them up a little bit and scare them. It was called Scared Straight. And it still is. I shouldn't talk about it in the past. It still happens. You know, I guess watching it sometimes, just to be very honest with you, there is a sense of like, well, you know, you kind of were a badass until you got in there, you know. So I just want to cop to that. I just want to be real. I don't want to sound perfect on these issues. There's a little part of me that when they see it and they get a little bit of their butt whooped around it, a little bit, not a lot, but just enough to not be a badass anymore.
Chris supports torture. That's my takeaway from this conversation. You heard it here first.
I do not support torture. And so this is the list of things that are being accused of happening in the troubled teen industry. Food and sleep deprivation, use of isolation and solitary confinement, forced to eat bodily fluids, emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, dangerous use of physical, chemical, and mechanical restraint methods, the punitive use of restraints, forced and excessive exercise, military methods of discipline, forced labor, deprivation of base necessities such as food, water, sleep, and access to a bathroom, restricted social interaction, of course, exposure to harsh elements like heat, snow, and rain on purpose, you know, not being properly dressed in the snow, being made to overdress in the heat, things like that. Use of what's called attack therapy, sexual shaming and forced sexualized behavior, sexual abuse as part of the treatment. These are all things, right, that when I say them, they almost sound like Guantanamo, right? Like these are things, if you told me this is what was going on in a prison camp somewhere, it would make sense to me. If you told me that this is where good parents from Iowa send their kids when their kids talk back to them, and this is what they get, I would think that we are a weird country. This is weird for America. And I feel a little bit ashamed as somebody who advocates so much that I did not know that there was this underbelly that goes this far. I knew that like the ALCs, the alternative learning centers, have issues. Like, you know, they're considered dumping grounds and they don't teach kids oftentimes. I shouldn't say that always. But this is such an underbelly. It feels like some enterprising state rep in every state would have written a bill about this already. Do you think that the Netflix series is going to be the catalyst for people thinking that they should, you know, they should do something? There should be some action here?
No.
That is so cynical.
Do you think it will be?
Well, I mean, I did see that, you know, California is actually leading, you know, on this. So they might pass something. That's what Paris Hilton is pushing in Cali. But, you know, I think in states where this might be the worst are the states where they wouldn't rein it in. I know Utah figures pretty prominently in this industry. And I think the one that Paris Hilton was sent to was in Utah. And they come up a lot. I don't think they'll change.
I think Chris, my question would be, I think when I say, no, I don't think things will change, is my takeaway from this Netflix series, and also from having paid attention to similar stories in the past, is what we heard from so many of the parents was, I just didn't know what else to do. And in some cases, I kind of wanted to roll my eyes, like, you know, one girl is sent there because she has a Mike's Hard Lemonade, which I consider a rite of passage more than a reason to go to a troubled teen industry. But to my point earlier about not having a lot of safety nets, what would you tell a parent who comes to you and says, I don't know how to parent my child anymore? Because I think until we have good answers for that, we're going to continue to see these places do well, no matter what type of litigation they could face.
I mean, there's going to be a range of parents, though, like a range of, I noticed that about the kids that were sent there. Some of them were sent there for things that, just like you said, are kind of just a rite of passage, or a little bit kind of on the, you know, being a naughty kid type of thing. Others, yeah, they had pretty serious problems, mental health problems, addiction problems, that I don't know that are 100% solved by sending them into an abuse camp. So I think it's a good question that you're asking, is like, what type of supports do we provide for families? Oh, we're a country that talks so much about families. Like, we're a country that, like, can't talk enough about families. Families are the basic building block of civilization. Well, then support them, goddammit. Right? Like, you know, if you really believe that families are like the building block of all Western society, I'm making fun of it because it's bogus. They don't follow it up with any action to support families. Like, healthcare supports great families. You know, a food supports great families. Lead-free neighborhoods actually supports families. There's so many things you could do if family was really the thing that you were after. And in this case, it would be making sure that we have enough mental health services, pediatric mental health services for kids that really need it, enough addiction programs that were therapeutic and not punitive, that cost money, but a society like ours should be able to afford that. If we can't afford that, we should stop calling ourselves Great America, right? The America the Great or whatever. And you know, I think where your question becomes a little bit more touchy is on the end of the spectrum where there's some real problems. Right? Like, you know, criminality, potential harm to siblings and others. You know, social workers see this all the time where they have to remove a kid from a family because the kid's just dangerous and there's a baby in the house, or, you know, there's some other reason to remove them. You also mentioned the foster care system. I think you do this a lot. You bring up stuff that problematizes even worse. It makes it even worse, because if I think about the system of children, the foster care system is definitely an off-ramp of, you know, what we normally think of about caring for children. You know, it's like an off-ramp. And so is child protective services. So I don't know that the Netflix special makes all the change in the world. I think what probably does is people hearing this and committing to doing something about it, whether it's just picking up the phone and calling their congressperson, writing a letter or an email to their congressperson, but just not just listening to this and doing, you know, like trauma tourism, where you go in and you go, my God, that was so bad. And I watched on Netflix, you know, in the comfort of my home. But every time, making a personal commitment that every time you see or do something, see something like this, you do something, I guess. So, Kate, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
I was going to make a suggestion about that, Chris, because not only is it Earth Day, but you chose this topic in April, which is also National Child Abuse Prevention Month and National Child Sexual Abuse Prevention Month. Apparently, we just need to worry about that just 1 month out of the year, yeah, and then we're fine. Just like the Earth just needs a day, so we're good there. But one thing that I was really struck by in the Netflix series, and it's a theme throughout the three episodes, is these kids are writing home, and yes, their letters are getting edited before they're sent, but you can still see that some of what gets to parents is kids saying, something is happening here that is not okay. I'm not safe. I need to get out. They talk about seeing their parents for visits, and some kids saying, there are dangerous things happening here. And so I think the most basic thing that we can learn to do is believe children and ask more questions. We have in the US, 1 in 10 kids will be sexually abused before they're 18. And I think the most recent data is from 2022 from the US Child and Family Bureau or something like that, that about per 1,000 kids will be physically abused each year, and that only 4 to 8% of kids are making false statements when they make an allegation that they are being hurt. But I think too often we don't believe them, or we think that they are exaggerating. And so I think the most important thing that we can do first is believe kids when they say something.
And have something happen, right? Like when they report, if nothing happens, then they learn the lesson that even saying something doesn't really help. One of those stats that you just said, actually something I've talked about for a long time, in the public schools, Congress wanted to see the rate of sexual abuse or sexual misconduct in public schools. So they pulled together experts nationally, and this was years ago, so I've written about this a while ago. So if people know me, they know I've talked about this before. But when they studied to see how prevalent it was exactly what you just said. It was 1 in 10. So 1 in 10 public school students will be the victim of sexual misconduct by a public school staff member in their lifetime, 1 in 10. So there are 50 million students in schools, in public schools, I think 50 million in public schools. So if you do the math about like if it was 1 in 10, that's a lot of kids. That's a lot of people. Like that's a lot of people that are walking around in the world having had something happen to them in school. And oftentimes it's the coach, it's the, you know, it's the band teacher or whatever who wants to be cool with the kids, you know, and does the cool thing. But it's not always, right? One of the things is, and this is opening up a whole other can of worms, so I don't want to go too far in it. It's a whole bunch of women. It's a whole bunch of women with boys. And the way that we look at boy sexual assault by women is totally different than the way that we look at other gendered assaults on children. You know, I've heard people say, well, you know, he should have enjoyed it type of thing. He's 12. He's 12. In the Mary Letourneau case, he was 12 years old. She was like 30-something and had a baby with him. And when she had the baby, he was on the hook for child support before he was 18 years old. This is how much we love children in the United States. We just love kids, love kids. All right. Well, I think I kind of opened a little bit of territory here, Kate. So we said all this lovely stuff about the kids who don't theoretically deserve some form of, you know, whatever. But what about the kids that are bad? Like, you know, I know we're not supposed to say that any kids are bad, but some of your children are bad, right? They do bad things. Like maybe people would prefer me to say it that way. Your kids do bad things to the point where they need some sort of help. What if your kid's just cussing you out, staying out late, doing drugs, refusing to accept any form of authority, not going to school, you know, stealing or whatever, you know, am I wrong to feel that little tinge of wanting some scared straight type of stuff to happen?
What's going on at home this week, Chris? No, I'm kidding.
My kids are spoiled. That's what's going on in my home. Yeah. Yeah.
So is my dog. That's why I don't have kids. I'm too busy spoiling a dog. Are you wrong? No, Chris, I don't think that you're wrong. I think that there are situations where the most accessible options for getting a kid help or correcting them are way too inaccessible for too many families who need them. I think my response to that is we have to find ways to make those options more accessible, whether that is funding, whether that is paying staff more so that they will stay and continue to grow those programs. We have a psychiatrist shortage in schools across the country. And so kids who might have developed serious issues from very early on don't have the resources in school, for example, to have that behavior seen and caught early so that we can help them before it turns into a problem. So I don't think you're wrong. I just think the answer is that we have to prioritize building these resources much more effectively than we currently are.
I don't know if you notice this, like while you watch the show, that most of the kids are white.
And they're in a program called WASP. It's perfect.
It's fitting. So your family has to be able to afford one of these programs to be able to send you. I mean, like $6,000 a month is no like drop in the bucket. That's a salary. That's a person's salary. And the only reason I bring that up is because as bad as it is, this would be considered a step up for what we do to the kids whose parents can't afford something like this. We just straight up throw them in jail or juvie or whatever. And, I had some special education mothers want to meet with me because they wanted to educate me on some stuff about special education. And they told me how much managing it takes for them to just like full-time manage their kid. that has special needs. Like they, some of them in some cases had to quit their job and now they're one income family because it's that much work. And when I asked about, you know, what happens with families that can't afford that, they were basically just like, oh yeah, those are the ones you throw in jail. And, you know, I've told that story many times because it affected me. It made me go, so when you have the time or the resources, you can provide this level of care for your kid that keeps them on track, even though it's a lot of work. Keeps them on track. But when you don't have those resources, they go a different direction. I even had a emergency room doctor tell me that principals were putting kids in ambulances because they didn't know where else to send them. So the hospital was getting all these kids in ambulances, which are very expensive, by the way, for the public, just to handle a school problem. And I think, you know, the other thing I'll add to this, we talked about this with Robbie on the show, is that there's an increase going on from everything that educators tell me about the level of problems in terms of mental health and students and student behavior is very much a problem right now. It's a big problem. And I think a lot of educators think that none of us want to talk about it. You know, we might have too much of that, like kind of liberal restorative justice stuff in our blood or, you know, I think, and my only point there, I think is to say that this is really bad what we're doing to these kids, but these are the kids that you can afford to spend, you know, $72,000 a year on to help them get correction. I think the other kids are probably in corrections, you know, somewhere wholesale, like a lot of kids. It saddens me. It saddens me. And I don't see any real, you know, immediate answers except for regulation, passing laws, changing structures and policies. I mean, name some of the things that you saw in this. Red flags in terms of the people running these schools that you saw in Netflix.
Great question. I've got a list. There was a moment where the producer who was at the facility for almost 2 years as a teenager sits down with an adult who was essentially hired as like a hall manager or something like that, a dorm parent. And the dorm parent is now a parent herself. And she says, I had no experience to be doing this work. I had nothing on my resume that would have said that I was capable of working with kids. I don't remember if I even went through a background check. And now that I have kids of my own, those are all questions that I would ask before I sent my kid anywhere, let alone somewhere that they were living. So that was a huge flag to me, is not only, as you said earlier, are these not educators, but if we aren't even running background checks, do we know what their past is with kids or what training they've gotten? There's a really...
And on that note, I'll just say this. Paris Hilton's abuser was kitchen staff, who I'm sure probably wasn't, you know, vetted in the way that you're saying. I didn't mean to stop you, but just wanted to put that out there. Like they have kitchen staff. They have all these unprofessional staff members who have access to the kids all day long, right? Which is crazy. All right, carry on. What else is on your list? The red flags.
Other red flags. So they depict a point in the series where the boys' side has planned and started to implement a riot. The kids are walking out. Other things that stood out to me, Chris, they, at one point in the series, they follow a man named Quentin, who was frequently in what they call the isolation room, which looks to be a room with no windows and is, I don't know, maybe 10 feet long, 10 feet wide. And you could be in there for days at a time. And he spent a lot of time in there. And he, along with one of the other boys in the boys' hall, planned a riot, and they were able to escape the hall that they were living on. And the plan had been that after they escaped, they would go and trash the room with all of the computers, because that would have to pause a lot of the learning that they were, quote unquote, learning that they were doing. And the boys all got distracted, because to get to the computer room, you have to pass through the kitchen. And they were so hungry because they were being so deprived of food that they paused the riot because they all saw the kitchen and needed to eat. And that need was greater than the freedom of getting out of the building. I don't know how that moment landed for you.
The same that it did for you. I think like the idea that we are really depriving people that much, something that's just basic like food. And the other thing is, you know, with that riot, they are so far out in the wilderness that I think they constantly told them that if like you try to escape, go for it. But You know, the only thing around us is miles and miles and miles and miles of trees. Like, that's all you got around you. So, you know, I think they also said in there, they wanted to make sure, because it was split between boys and girls, different buildings, and they wanted to make sure that the boys didn't get to the girls' building and let them know that there was a riot afoot, because then it would have been a full scale kind of problem. So they wanted to isolate it just to the boys. And some of the girls said they didn't even know there had been a riot. They didn't even know, like, you know, this had taken place. It does say a lot about the, it says a lot about the spirit of the human. It says a lot, like, you can force us to do a lot of things, but you get to a certain place where we've had enough. And I, you know, I think that's actually what I learned about that moment. Some of my red flags are all around accreditation stuff, right? You have a father and son running a business to do this, and they have no education background. The son is in charge of the educational program. The kids are supposed to be getting an educational program, but they're using some weird third-party homeschooling, you know, thing that nobody knows where, like, what it's supposed to be doing, but it's definitely not teaching. So the lack of regulation of who can run one of these, the lack of regulation around what still qualifies as an education, like, no matter who does this, kids still deserve and have a human right to a basic education. That was a problem. The number of complaints that there were with no action. Like, the number, there are lawsuits now. Parents are suing. It's a red flag that this becomes a known issue and just nothing happens from there. So all of those things were red flags to me in terms of what you would expect. You would expect if these are called schools. They're called schools. They're not called camps. They're called boarding schools. The Hidden Lake Academy, where Clarence Thomas sent his nephew, is called a therapeutic boarding school, right? Like, that's pretty interesting for a name for a, you know, a gulag, therapeutic, you know, boarding school. Anyway, so those are all my kind of like red flags. I think if you would have solved any of the things that I just said, we wouldn't even have the story right now. If they were regulated, if you had to be accredited, if your educational program had to be a real program that was monitored by the state to make sure that there wasn't educational neglect going on, all of those things would have, I think, thrown up flags for the state. Imagine you don't agree.
I completely agree. I completely agree. I think I actually wrote this down. I paused the show to write this down. One of the quotes near the end of the series, one of the women says, "The abuse of a child is the business of anyone who knows about it." And I think that quote is powerful. It is also, I think, a remark on the town that this facility was in, because you come to realize that most people in the town knew exactly what was going on and just stayed out of it. And so I think we have a lot of reflecting to do ourselves on what are the things that we stay out of and what are the fights we choose to get involved in.
Wow. I think that's a super elegant way to end the show. That is a very powerful quote. Just so telling. All the townspeople really did know what was going on there, and they did nothing. So the bystander effect of all this, none of us should be bystanders. And that's kind of my final word on all of this. It's one thing to do trauma vacations where you find out about something like this and it makes kind of like a, you know, good watching, good viewing on a Netflix show. It's another thing to take it as a call to action to do something to bring justice about for children, for young people. I know I will commit myself to making something happen in this. This won't just be a show that we do. This will be something I can report to you later, that I took some action in some way, shape, or form on this. And I hope you will too. And in terms of taking actions, there's another action I think you might be able to take, which is to help us spread the show and increase the number of people that are watching the show. And you can do that by, number one, rating us wherever you get your podcast and leaving us a review. Hopefully it's a good review. Hopefully you find the show informative and engaging and entertaining, and you want to share it with others. So as always, we really appreciate you. This has been another episode of The Citizen Stewart Show, and we will see you on the next show. The Citizen Stewart Show is a production of the Branch Media Podcast Network. I'm Chris, Citizen Stewart. You can follow me at Citizen Stewart. You can follow Ravi at Ravi M. Gupta. You can follow all of The Branch's podcast at The Branch Media on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And check out our website at thebranchmedia.org. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review, give us a 5-star rating, and subscribe to the show so you can join us every Tuesday for more of The Citizen Stewart Show. We'll